until I heard all that. Well, it's really a pleasure to be here and to be part of this really fantastically interesting workshop. I wasn't sure who the audience would be, so I'm kind of pitching this at a mixed level. I want to talk about, at least I realize that a lot of the things I've been thinking about recently have to do with, in one way or another, the kind of invariants of manifolds that get collected in forming what's called a topological field theory. And it's made me go back and think, as a topologist, you know, what is really the nature of a topological field theory, and what is it that this object is asking us as topologists to do? And it's been kind of just an interesting philosophical journey, and made me think back about the very origins of our subject and look at some of those things in a different light. So at least in the first half of the talk today, I just want to go through kind of the beginnings of the subject of algebraic topology and talk about how things look a little different looking back on them. So excuse me just one sec. That was to remind me to mention string theory, and I'm also now, and that was to remind me to mention that this is joint work with Dan Fried and Constantine Telemann. And many of the things I say aren't particularly original to me. And one thing I'll definitely be talking about is a point of view on higher categories and topological field theories that's definitely not due to me, and I've been influenced by papers of Bertram Twain and many other people on this. But so anyway, if I get caught up in the telling and forget to mention names, it's not because I'm not. Okay, let me get down to it. So anyway, you know, the very beginning of algebraic topology comes about from trying to come to grips with one invariant. And that invariant is the degree of a map. So this degree comes up in all kinds of ways in the late part of the 19th century. It comes about counting the number of solutions to a polynomial equation in different ways. And in the topological picture, you're just counting the number of points in the inverse image of a map. So I might have a map of a large, I might have a map from a circle down to another circle, or a map from a sphere down to some other sphere, and we get an invariant of this map by picking a point in this sphere and counting the number of points that lie over it. So this number here, the number of these, is the degree of the map. So this is a picture of my map, F. So at the very beginning, we're trying to relate something that's really a number to something that has to do with topology. It has to do with a space. Now I drew a very special kind of picture of this, and there's maybe one that has that's simpler, but illustrates a different feature. So now I want to draw a different map from a sphere to itself, but in this one, let's imagine that it's just mapping down to the front half of this circle and not hitting the back. So if I pick this point, then it looks like the degree is 2. But if I pick this point, it looks like the degree is 0. And so it looks like, from this picture, the degree is not something well-defined. But if you look more carefully at the geometry, we can orient these circles. We can give each point here a preferred direction. And we can do the same thing with this circle. And if we look at the orientations of these points compared to the orientation of the circle, we find that one of them is consistent with that orientation and the other one has the reverse. So we're supposed to think of this one as positive and this one as negative. And now if we remember to count these as positive and negative points, then the degree is well defined. This is 1 plus negative 1, equaling zero. So already, just in retrospect, already trying to count using topology forced us to use negative numbers. It forced us to get away from, we're not no longer counting a physical quantity, we're counting an idealized quantity, because we've been forced to interpret certain points as negative. Okay, so this was the picture, in the early part of the 20th century, it was proved that that two maps between spheres of the same dimension are homotopic if and only if they have the same degree, and this was sort of really a triumph of our understanding of spaces and the maps between them and of the power of this particular invariant. So in the 1930s, Pontryagin came up with a generalization of this to higher dimensions that really has some amazingly profound ideas in it. So in Pontryagin's picture, he now looks at a map of manifolds of different dimensions. So so this is supposed to be a two-sphere, although it kind of got punched in. And I'll map it down to a circle again. And again, I'm just going to draw it so that it's hitting the front half. And let's see. Let's suppose this is a sphere of dimension n plus d, and this is a sphere of dimension d. Now, if I try the same trick, and I pick a point here, the inverse image of that point, well, if this is a generic value, there will be an n-parameter space of points here mapping to a single one. So in my picture, I have a one-dimensional manifold, a one-dimensional surface sitting over this point. So if I start with this map F, the degree of F is no longer just a set of points here, it's something with more geometric structure. And that geometric structure is a manifold. So let's call the collection of these two circles sitting next to each other M, and the degree of F is some kind of M, some kind of shape, a manifold of dimension N. All right, well, here we were forced to introduce negative numbers. What's going to happen here? If I pick a different point, the inverse image will be a different manifold, and I'm left with a kind of a strange relationship between them. So let's call this M primed. Let me just redraw the picture. So here I have just this little segment of the circle down there, and up here I have this manifold M primed here, and this manifold M, and there's some piece of surface that's mediating between M and M primed called W. So W is known as a cobordism between M and M primed. So M and M primed give the same degree if there's a W with the boundary of W equal to M union M primed. I mean, I really want to carry a little more structure along. I want it sitting over this interval, but this is the idea. And this W is called a cobordism between M and M primed. And I'll write it like this when I draw it. Okay, so Pontryagin's idea Pontryagin's way of investigating this higher dimensional counting or understanding what replaced the notion of degree in higher dimensions led to this this relationship that you probably wouldn't have thought of for another, for any other reason. It led to a very deep relationship, or a very deep idea that we want to consider two manifolds or two shapes to be equivalent if they're related by a cobordism. All right. So you can think of this as just a higher dimensional notion of counting. In this case, we could work out that the values of what we're counting are just numbers, and here the values are going to live in some more abstract place. They might live in an abelian group, or they might live in a ring. And unless there's something special about the geometry, it's probably kind of difficult to work out what the actual structure of that ring is. But nevertheless, there's a very, very good theoretical understanding of this kind of invariant. So let me talk a little more formally about it. It's a laser pointer. Okay, right. Let's talk a little bit more formally about it. So if we're going to count the degree, we're going to look at an invariant. I mean, here what we did was we took the number of these points, positive and negative, and canceled them. And now here I need a more abstract formalism. So these are what I want to call the classical or cobordism invariants. Of manifolds. So I want something that associates to every manifold M something I'll call Z of M, which you can think of as a number. It was in the case that I was first starting with, but well, let's just think of it as living in some abstract abelian group or some abstract place. So and this association is supposed to have two properties. It should be linear. So if I calculate it on a disjoint union of manifolds, I'll get the sum. And it's also supposed to not change. I'm supposed to get the same value on two manifolds that are related by a cobordism. So if M1 is cobordant to M2, then Z of M1 equals Z of M2. So without working out all the possible ways of doing this, we could say that Pontryagin gives us, well, we could say that the set of maps between spheres defines for us a cobordism invariant. Or we could say we could think about calculating the maps between spheres by writing down a bunch of cobordism invariants and trying to detect those maps. So in this case, the classical theorem of Brouwer that tells us that two maps are homotopic if and only if they have the same degree can be thought of as calculating that space by working out all of the possible cobordism invariants for zero-dimensional manifolds. Okay, so there's one other point I want to make about this before kind of stepping back and ruminating a little. But let me hang on a second. Yeah, okay. Let me just make one more point, and then I want to step back a little bit. So here's the classic example of a cobordism invariant, and that's the signature. So if I have a manifold, then its cohomology ring with coefficients in the real numbers will be, let's suppose M has is even dimensional, then let's suppose it's 4n-dimensional, and I'll I'll look at the middle cohomology. This is a vector space with a quadratic form. So this has a non-degenerate bilinear form by Poincaré duality. And that quadratic vector space has a single invariant. Well, it has its dimension and then one other invariant, which is the signature. So the signature of M is the signature of this quadratic form. So it's the if I choose a basis where every element either squares to, if I try to choose an orthonormal basis, well, since I'm over the reals, some I can make it all orthogonal, but then some people will square to positive numbers and some of my basis elements will square to negative numbers, and I take the number of positive ones minus the number of negative ones, and that's the signature. So it's a the classic theorem of Hirzebruch, or of Kalm, actually, that this in, that this is a cobordism invariant, and so there's a theorem due to Kalm when n is 1, and Hirzebruch in general, that this number can be calculated as an integral over M of something that only depends on the tangent bundle to M. So this is the signature formula, or signature theorem. Now, this is kind of an amazing thing, if you step back and think about it. We had an invariant of a manifold that its key property, the key thing it was invariant of, was of structures that were external to the manifold. It, being a cobordism invariant, there's no way I can tell just from living in the manifold if something you've calculated is a cobordism invariant. I would have to know about all cobordisms relating me to somebody else and all those, the calculations of those. But this says that this cobordism invariant can be calculated as an accumulation of local things in M. And not only that, the accumulation depends only on the linear approximation to M at every point, namely the tangent bundle, and not much more of the geometry. So this is really kind of an amazing fact. And the thing that's even more amazing is that this is the general story. So the more amazing general fact is the following result. So let's see. I'm going to try to put some names up here, maybe in chronological order. So this is Kalm, Hirzebruch, Atiyah and Singer, and probably many others. But there's the following fact, that if Z is any cobordism invariant, then Z of M can be calculated as an integral over M of something that depends only on the local linear approximation to M. Now, there's a little bit I have to say about this formula. This integral isn't the kind of where you integrate x squared and you get x cubed over 2. This is an integral in a generalized cohomology theory. There might be one that does give you x. Yeah, okay. Did I say x squared that gives you x squared over 2? I did. But I said x cubed over 2. I thought you guys were all laughing at my joke. Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, you were calculating, and that's why. Yeah. Well, it's right in my notes. No. All right. Do you do course evaluations for this distinguished lecture theory? All right. Oh, no. Okay. All right. Anyway, if I have the theorem is that this is always true, but this is in a general cohomology theory, and this is a characteristic class of the tangent bundle in that general cohomology theory. Okay. So this is a really triumphant accounting of this old story about the degree, starting with trying to count points, just starting with counting, but trying to relate it to something geometric. We were led into this relation of cobordism, and then deep into the heart of algebraic topology, and we find in the end we have a very complete way of accounting for, in theory, all of these kind of invariants. Now, I want to start talking about the quantum version of this, but let's see. There's a few things that I never thought about the first time I learned about this material that kind of have jumped out in my new thinking about it. So one is this picture right up here. From the very beginning, from the very minute it's introduced, a cobordism, it's true, it's a relation between manifolds, but it corresponds to a path in a space. So let's see. Let me make a little note of some of these things. So one thing is, so in hindsight, there's some kind of remarks to notice. One is a cobordism is a path in a space, or it corresponds to a path in a space. And in fact, you can build spaces out of manifolds and cobordisms. So the thing is about this, see, a path in a space is, if I walk down a path in a space, I can always turn around and walk back down the other way. That's a reversible relationship. And so anyway, that's one thing. Well, I want to just point out now, but also to notice that, I mean, this cohomology theory is kind of built out of a space where the paths are cobordisms and relations between the cobordisms. And so this notion of cobordism becomes extremely tied up with our topologist notion of space. So that's one point. It's a path in a space, but somehow it's really telling us what space is. So that's one thing that you see that kind of comes out as significant looking back on this. The other thing that I'll just mention because it came up in one of the earlier talks today is that we started out trying to count. That had to do with numbers and integers and things. And then we wound up with realizing that there was this higher version of counting involving manifolds and cobordisms. And this I want to think of as a kind of a refinement of the idea of counting. After all, if I wanted to just go back to integers, what I would do is I would forget about higher dimensional manifolds, I'd forget about any internal geometric structures they had, and just remember the points, and just remember to count them. So, if you look back, we heard a talk about elliptic cohomology and topological modular forms this morning. If you look back at the history of the theory of elliptic functions and elliptic curves, you find Wallace in the 1600s calculating the arc length of an ellipse and getting some function that he'd never seen before. And so we started, mathematicians then got these new elliptic integrals, and there was 100 or so years of playing around trying to express things in terms of elliptic integrals, which were functions of complex variable. And then Abel, and especially Jacobi, in around 1830, he had several amazing ideas, but one is he inverted the elliptic integrals and made what we call elliptic functions. And so they were used, well, these integrals, they were used in all kinds of problems in mathematical physics. If you want to calculate how the motion of a pendulum, you need elliptic integrals. If you want to calculate well, there's a fundamental solution of the heat equation is given in terms of theta functions on surfaces, and that's another use of these. But Jacobi also made this amazing observation that when you write down the Fourier expansion, the coefficients you get are integers, and these integers hold deep number theoretic properties. And it's kind of an amazing thing. How can something that was designed to take continuous input retain for us discrete information like integers and deep theorems about numbers? Well, it took a long time, but eventually I think that the explanation emerged that these are functions on the moduli space of elliptic curves, and that moduli space has a definition as a scheme over the integers. So that certainly, we saw the Tank curve written down this morning. Once I've defined something over the integers, then the functions are automatically going to have integers as coefficients. And then we heard about, well, so here, looking back again at integers, they came up in counting. Looking back at how that came in, how topologists encountered that, we see that cobordism of manifolds is also supposed to be that's a refinement of integers. And in fact, the theory of topological modular forms, which you heard mentioned in Jacob's talk this morning, is a refinement, and in Jacob's hands, it literally is a lift of the. It's a new step in that direction. Instead of being over the complex numbers, instead of being over the integers, you define elliptic curves over the sphere. And then your coefficients of your functions, instead of being complex numbers or integers, are automatically manifolds. They're automatically cobordism invariants. So the other thing that these cobordism invariants have to do with is it has to do with doing geometry over the sphere. Instead of over the integers. So I don't know. You can really see this kind of algebraic geometry kind of also arising in the same spirit. It really in Pontryagin's hands, this was a replacement for the integers, a replacement for counting. So I don't know. It's kind of fun to go back and look at how many of these ideas go back to some natural questions and then some unexpected constructions. Okay, all right. Well, enough of that ruminating. Let me move ahead to the thing I wanted to talk about, which are the newer invariants or the quantum invariants. So what I want to talk about now are, well, I guess I'll just erase these. So this, I'm kind of giving this a name just so it fits the way I'm setting out the narrative of the talk here. But what I really am talking about is something called a topological field theory. And it's a structure introduced by Witten in around 1988, and Atiyah and others. Okay, so for these quantum invariants, we imitate the basic structure of a cobordism invariant with some slight variations. So now I'm going to associate to each manifold Z of M, but I'm not going to pin myself down into saying what it is. It's just something, some object. If I take a disjoint union, I get a way of combining these objects. So this, in this case, will be, I'll just use the symbol tensor to denote some kind of strictly speaking, a symmetric monoidal structure, but some kind of way of combining objects. So this up here might, for example, be a vector space over the complex numbers, and this might correspond to tensor product, but there's other mathematical objects that we might consider here. So far it looks just like cobordism invariance, except for we've changed the look of that symbol. But here's the sort of the kicker, is this axiom that if I have a cobordism between two manifolds, what I get, I don't get that two things are equal, I get a map. I'm sorry, I've drawn this picture badly. I get a map from my invariant of M1 to my invariant of M2. But that map's not necessarily an isomorphism. And in fact, I should really have said I get an isomorphism here. So there's two differences. One is just replacing this notion of sum by tensor, which is a sort of, in a way, maybe you could think of that as a more superficial difference. And then the sort of deep one is that what we were looking at before, which were things that did not change if I had a cobordism, we're now asking for just a relationship, just a map. Now there's a few more axioms which I don't think I will spell out, but I'll just go through some examples, and in the telling, you know, just mention some of these properties. I mean, they're natural things like if I concatenate cobordisms, it corresponds to a composition of maps, and if I have a diffeomorphism of a manifold, I get a map. There are things like that which will come out in the telling. But maybe I can say something right now, which is, now let me do some examples just really quickly, a couple of, just to show you that there's some that there are some interesting things going on even in the most simple situation. So let's do an example, and we will consider oriented manifolds of dimension zero. So this is the thing that in the classical case led to the ring of integers. And now we want to work out, what do we get when we're quantum counting oriented? What do we get when we're quantum counting oriented points? Well, let's see, what are the oriented zero manifolds? There's a point. Now, there's a sneaky way of thinking of this, and there's a straightforward way. The sneaky way is, what's an orientation of a vector space? It's a choice of direction. It's a choice of one of the components in the top exterior power of that vector space. So, right, the top exterior power will be a real line, and I want a that has two non-zero components. When I remove zero, I have two components. The tangent space to that is zero-dimensional, so the sneaky thing you have to think is, okay, the top exterior power of a zero-dimensional vector space is the zeroth exterior power, and it's still a one-dimensional vector space. And so a point has two possible orientations. In topology, the way these things come up in Pontryagin and Thom's work is it's not the tangent bundle you orient. You embed your manifold into a Euclidean space and you orient the normal bundle. So if I think of these points as sitting inside this line, there's two possible orientations of a point. So I have two zero manifolds, and then I can take disjoint unions of these. Oh, and there's one other one. There's the empty manifold of dimension zero. All right, so let's follow those axioms. So this is supposed to go to a vector space I'll call V. This is supposed to go to a vector space I'll call W. And this one has to go to a vector space which, if I look at this property here and take this to be the empty set, the vector space I get is one such that when I tensor it with any vector space, I get that vector space back, canonically. And so this, that more or less forces this to go to the vector space of complex numbers.
All right.
Okay, what happens if I take, let's look at some cobordisms. So here's one. That goes from two of these manifolds to the empty manifold. So that gives me a map from V tensor W to the complex numbers. But it doesn't tell me they have to be the same. It just gives me a map. And then I also have one which I'll draw in this direction. So that goes from the complex numbers to W tensor V. And let's see, I can concatenate these. I could concatenate these in several different ways. So one would be like this, where we like that. So that will tell me that, so this thing is just this thing crossed the interval. One of the axioms will be that that's the identity map, and this tells me that if I start with V and I go to V to V tensor W tensor V. Here's my V. Here's V tensor W tensor V, and then I go out by this one, so that gets me back to V. That this has got to be the identity map. And just in the interest of time, there's a dual diagram involving that interchanges the role of V and W, and this implies that V is the W is the dual of V. And if I give V a basis, and W the dual basis, then the map that corresponds to this picture is the map that sends 1 to the sum of EI tensor EI star. So that's a little formal maneuver that you can carry out if you wish. Okay. Okay, so that's easy. That tells us that we could work out all of these, and we find we get a theory of vector spaces and their duals. But there's another one manifold we could look at, which is this one. It's another cobordism, and just to be definite, let's have it go like that. Okay, so that's a cobordism from the empty zero manifold to the empty zero manifold. So it has to correspond to a map from the complex numbers to itself, and that map will be multiplication by lambda for some lambda. Let's calculate lambda. I'm going to take this circle and break it in half. And just regard it as gotten by concatenating these two cobordisms. So this sends, and now we can calculate, this sends 1 to the sum of EI tensor EI dual, and then this other map contracts those, so that goes to the sum of 1, which is the dimension of V. So we find that lambda is the dimension of V. Now, this is all very elementary, but there's already a couple of things to notice about this. One is that this is not a cobordism invariant, because a disjoint union of two circles is cobordant to one of them, as the picture I drew shows at the very beginning. And, of course, there's not very many numbers that square to themselves. there's only two of them, and anyway, I can surely set up take any finite dimensional vector space and produce this theory. So one thing, this is not a cobordism invariant. And the other thing is, it's lambda is an integer. So it got quantized. So this is the mechanism by which continuous quantities get quantized. They get attached to, they become part of a field theory like this, and things that might have had a continuum of possible values wind up restricted to be an integer. So this is one of the reasons, you can think of this as one of the reasons of for calling these quantum invariants. Okay, all right, let me do another example. I'm going to try to do it sort of quickly. So just to show you, there's really something into these structures, even in the simplest cases. So let's do another case. Oh, let me point out a generalization of this argument. If I have a diffeomorphism of a manifold, and I form the mapping torus, so let's see, that's gotten by taking my manifold, crossing it with an interval, and then gluing the two ends together by the map F. Then if I'm in this situation where Z of M is a vector space, then Z of F will be a map. And this same calculation will tell you that Z of this mapping torus is the trace of Z of F. Okay, you just do this. It just follows from that exact construction. Okay, I want to use this. That's why I stopped a minute. So here is a. Here's another example of this structure. Now I want to take, just consider quantum points, but now I want to consider these points as having a spin structure. Okay, so I'm going to draw the same picture. Actually, the pictures I'm drawing of a zero manifold, these represent a trivialization of the normal bundle, and so that also isolates a spin structure for me, as well as an orientation. Now, everything looks more or less the same. There's just as many spin zero manifolds as there are oriented zero manifolds, but there's a new feature, and that is a spin zero manifold has an automorphism. You can take this spin structure and spin it. That's why it's called spin. And you get an automorphism of the spin structure. So we'll call this epsilon, and this epsilon squares to the identity map. So a spin point has there's a non-trivial auto. It doesn't physically act on the point, but it changes the. It transforms the spin structure. Okay. So there's an automorphism of that. All right, so that means that I'm going to get an automorphism if V is the value on this spin point, then V has an involution. So we can decompose V into the plus 1 and the minus 1 eigenspaces of epsilon. And we'll think of the vectors that are in this state as being, this corresponds to a spin up state, and this corresponds to a state having spin down. All right, so that's one new feature. And now the other thing that you see is that there's another one manifold. So let me draw it. And I'll draw the, so I've drawn it in the plane so that I can, so there's a difference, so there's two spin one manifolds. There was only one oriented one manifold. The one with the outward orientation and the one with the inward orientation are diffeomorphic, but here there's a new spin one manifold. So let's try to calculate Z of this. I'm sorry? I mean, this is always a little bit of a confusing thing. What you could ask for the spin, I mean, this is a one manifold, so, but I could ask for the total space of the spin bundle on it, and this is one of these things where I'm not going to be able to do it on my feet. I one time remembered, oh, it always works out to be the opposite of what I think it is, and now I don't know what to think it is anymore. But one of these, if you take the spin bundle on a point, on a circle, the two possibilities, one of them is the Mobius band and the other is the trivial one, but it's always the opposite one that I think it is, so I'm afraid I don't know. This is the non-bounding spin manifold, so it is related to the Mobius band. Okay, I want to calculate this Z. All right, well, look, what is this? What did I do? I took my piece of string and I took my spin manifold and I turned it. I haven't drawn this very well. What this works out to be is you. Oh, I see. Maybe I know what you were asking. This isn't actually the Mobius band. If you want to think of this picture, this is turned. You take your strip and you turn it 360 degrees around, not 180. But so that means, if you draw it that way, that means what this is the mapping torus of that spin automorphism. So this is the mapping torus of epsilon. Okay, and therefore Z is equal to the trace of epsilon, which is the dimension of V plus minus the dimension of V minus. On the other hand, look, I can break this up in a different way. Let's mark these points here. So if I look at it this way, what I did was I took these two points and I crossed them with an interval. And then instead of gluing them together, what I did was I just switched their positions. Okay, so Z is also, so it's also the mapping torus of flip, of just flipping the position of two of these spin zero manifolds. Well, look, that means that Z has to be the trace of the flip map from V tensor V to itself. Now, if I take that just to be the ordinary one that takes two vectors and just takes A tensor B and sends it to B tensor A, then that's going to be the that's going to be the dimension of V, that trace. But that's the dimension of V plus the dimension of V minus. So this looks like we have a problem here. This could only make sense if the dimension of V minus is zero. Well, there's another way it could make sense. It could make sense if we worked with graded tensor products instead of the usual tensor products. So this tells us, so in order to have V minus be non-zero, this tells us that if V minus is non-zero, we must use graded tensor products and graded commutativity. Well, this is the spin statistics theorem, or maybe a baby version of that. And it's telling you that in order to have fermions, in order that if I take two particles that are in a spin minus state or in a half spin state, and I interchange their position, they have to be like fermions. There has to be a sign in the interchange rule. If you're following this and you really know about cobordism and all that, this is relating eta, the Hopf map, to the graded commutativity. The convention for graded commutativity is a tensor product of graded vector spaces. Anyway, I wanted to mention this to tell you that coming to grips with cobordism invariance, it actually forces you into some pretty interesting algebraic constructs. So this story goes on. There are many, many more. There are many, many more examples of this. Well, maybe not that so many, but let me just tell you that. So there's further examples. If I have a theory that's relating one and two manifolds, so if I have one and two manifolds, then this kind of structure gives me a Frobenius algebra. And if I have one, two, and three manifolds, then the thing that's attached to the one manifold is a modular tensor category. So out of trying to come to grips with these quantum invariants, you meet some really, really elaborate mathematical structures. I think I had hoped to have quite a bit more time at this point, but let me tell you what if they weren't recording this, I would call this a dream, but I don't want that to be on the internet forever. So I think I'm going to say an ambition. No, I can't think of a word. A dream? Okay, all right. I keep asking people if there's a really good pithy word like Jugendtraum that means the dearest dream of when you're in your late middle age. And the only thing everyone goes, oh yeah, that's, and then they say this German word, and then we look it up and we realize that means the Middle Ages. So I don't know. This is the dearest dream of the Middle Ages. Dream. I think it would be really, really cool, and I think this whole setup is asking us topologists to try to do this, is to account for, is a formula, to write Z of M as an accumulation of something local in M. Okay, well, this is a quantum, so write this, where this is a quantum invariant, and this is some kind of accumulation of local information in M. Now, I guess I don't have as much time as I'd hoped, but let's just step back for a minute and think about what this is asking us as topologists to do. See, this accumulation of local information, in order to do that for the classical, for cobordism invariants, we built these cobordism spaces. And those spaces had points were manifolds, paths were cobordisms. And now we're supposed to drop this idea that cobordisms are a path. A cobordism, in a quantum invariant, a cobordism just gives me a map. So, and a map isn't necessarily an isomorphism. So we have to work.
So this demands doing algebraic topology with,
well, the way I've set it up, I guess you would, I would like to call them directed spaces. But the mathematical, what they really are, just so that I'm not hiding anything, is higher categories. So what is a directed space? Well, let's see.
Spaces have points in them. And then I have some points can be connected by a path.
Well, in a directed space, a path has a direction. If I'm here and I go visit my, I'm home safe with my parents and I walk over to the next door neighbor where they're all monsters and I want to turn around and go back home, I can't in a directed space because the paths only go in one direction. But you're supposed to think of this as actually happening in higher dimensions as well. So if I had a triangle like this, this region of space in between is also directed. And I think the way the convention is, it's supposed to go in this direction. So if I was standing on this point and waiting for my friend Mary, and she came up and said, "Oh, hi. Oh, I brought my friend Bill. I'd like you to meet him." And you turned in this direction and you shook hands with Bill, it'd be like you got a terrible thing in your neck and you couldn't possibly, you can't turn back because the space is directed. And as much as you'd rather be talking to Mary, you've got to spend the rest of your life talking to Bill because this space is directed. And you're supposed to think of this as happening in every dimension. If I was to build a three simplex, there's an orientation in here and on up. Well, look, I didn't kind of manage the time very well, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about the point of view I find very beautiful, that connects very well with these kind of cobordism theories. But maybe I'll just put some names up. So there's So in the first instance, there's Joyal and his quasi-categories. And they've been developed by Jacob Lurie as well as Joyal. But so these are things where they're directed up to, well, in this dimension, you don't have this problem in dimension two. They're only sort of directed in dimension one. The version that I find that really works well with trying to formulate this and do algebraic topology with these spaces is are the complicial sets of Dominic Verity and Ross Street. These fit very well with the models for cobordism spaces that came up in geometric topology, the Quinn spaces and others. And it's really a challenge to really try to think about how to use the methods of algebraic topology to even formulate a result like this and to try to learn to do homotopy theory in this world. It's really a challenge. And I'll just say one of the things you run into, one of our most basic techniques in topology is to take a space and approximate it by a chain complex. You might build it out of cells. You might take a Posnikov tower. But one way or another, you approximate a space by an abelian group, and then you make some kind of calculations. Abelian groups are illegal if I'm not allowed to invert things. I mean, I'm not allowed to subtract in this world. So if we went back to our counting points, I don't get negative numbers for dimensions of vector spaces. I'm not allowed to subtract. So I have to work with monoids, and I'm not allowed to work with groups. And I believe, although I haven't really been able to even get these kind of calculations rolling, that the linear approximation that you would use, the substitute for the Posnikov tower, will involve simplicial commutative monoids. You'll have to replace the notion of chain complex with simplicial commutative monoid. And this just seems to be a much more mysterious thing to deal with. Well, I think I'll stop here. And in my next talks, I'm not going to focus on such a general point. I in my next talk, two talks, I want to discuss specific examples of these topological field theories and some of the ways algebraic topology is able to get at them. So, but I really like how this notion of a topological field theory takes us topologists back to the fundamental questions that really started the whole subject and makes us look at them in a completely new light. All right, thank you. Okay.
But it's also my responsibility to notify you that there will be a reception out in the atrium after the questions are over. So, questions. don't feel intimidated or thirsty.
I can't hear anybody, but I might just be getting bad reception. oh, is that a question? Yeah, you know, I actually, preparing the talk, I thought I was going to spend about 20 minutes giving the definition of completional sets. But I think I'm happy to do that, but maybe I should do it for the small number of those who are really interested. But yeah, it's, let me just tell you, yeah. It's a little bit like Andre's model category. You know, he has a different model category structure on simplicial sets, and there's a completional sets. That's simplicial sets with a little extra data, and then there's a model category structure on that. And but there's you can forget and get an ordinary. Yeah, let's do this later. There's a little bit of a story there.
I'm not sure that's going to encourage anybody to ask any more questions.
Oh, really? I'd love to answer another question. Yeah.
In quantum theory, found anything out of playing in quantum theory. Of course, here it's a topological quantum theory, maybe where they don't play any role. Do you think that
I think so. I think that this accumulation process that I'm asking about is supposed to be some topologist mechanism for calculating a Feynman integral. But I mean, in some sense, that is a Feynman integral. You can think of the L as being the Lagrangian, but it's only in some very simple cases where I know how to give even a direct accounting of this, and I hesitated to say dream because I don't really even know if this is possible, but it raises some very, very interesting questions. Anyway, I think the answer to your question was that that integral sign is supposed to be a Feynman integral. Yeah, I mean, let's suppose I had one of these directed spaces or higher categories that just had a single point, but you could leave that point, walk back to it. So then these paths I'm forming can be composed. And they form a monoid. In an ordinary space, the paths that went from one point back to itself form a group because I can walk backwards. Here they just form a monoid. And so the easiest version. So then in topology, you take something like a group and then you try to approximate it with abelian things. So the easiest versions of these would be when they're commutative. Anyway, the same thing happens in higher dimensions when you're trying to paste together higher simplices and understand how the space is built up. Again, you meet monoids instead of groups. I don't know. Did you want a more technical answer? I'm not sure. Oh, okay. So, sure, right. Yeah, you can think of it. So we could model, in that language, we could model spaces with simplicial groups. Let's just give ourselves groups at the beginning, and then we could, if we were trying to investigate those, we might simplify these groups by looking at the lower central series or somehow approximating them by abelian groups, and then that would give me simplicity. I could try to portray every simplicial abelian group as a simplicial group is assembled from simplicial abelian groups. So the analog of that in this story is a simplicial monoid. The groups were there because they were thought of as the loop groups of spaces, and now the loop things here are monoids. And so if you pass to the group, you've thrown away kind of the more subtle, higher categorical information. Ezra?
Your zero-dimensional theory, you produced, I guess, five-dimensional vector spaces. And in the work of Madden and Vines and Galatas, they look at cobordisms where they're non-empty, let me say, then you just get a vector space with a inner product, or a pair of vector spaces with a pairing. You wouldn't get the circle and stuff. And yet they're able to prove, I guess, a large fraction of the theorem that they'd like to prove. This is very vague, but there seems to be ways get around some non-invertibility. Do you see anything like that in a more general
context? This is very related to the work of Galatius, Madsen, and Weiss, I don't think I got far enough to be able to tell you how. But one thing I don't know of any real examples of these topological field theories where it doesn't come up like you describe, where you only kind of have half the theory, and you get the other half by some kind of duality or observing that some trace pairing is non-degenerate. And I don't know. I'm trying to just formulate in topological terms the whole theory, and I haven't even started thinking about what in general you would need to do to go from the partial information that tends to come up in nature to the whole theory. Yeah, I don't have much useful to say about that.
No. Let's save other questions for informal discussion, and don't forget to come back tomorrow at 3:30.
Thank you.